Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, the capital asset pricing model. A few mentions along the way here. I will have a surprise quiz on Wednesday, so please be surprised by it, and it will cover chapters 7 and 8 in my lectures. And then I should also mention you have 12 days to do the Excel certification. You started out with 77 and now it's coming down to the wire. And make sure that you don't try to do it all in one evening on the last day. Get that done. And if you have any problems with getting the URL of your certificate, you come to the office and we'll get it fixed up, make sure that you've got the right web address for your certificate to submit in the assignment window in Canvas. Okay. Going on to the fun for the day, we have a bear day. It's going to be a lot of bear days. You may remember on Monday we had a bull day, and as I had said, that was a dead cat bounce. We're back, the cats landed again, and so we are now in definite bear territory with a bear market. As you can see, starting on the other side of the world, like, for example, the Nikkei is up nicely today, very nicely. Japan's going to be just fine, as is most of the rest of the world. They have declined to join the regional war in the Middle East, and so their economies are going to do just fine. And so we have Nikkei 225 is doing good. We have the Hang Seng doing well. Australia seemed to have a bad day. Not sure what the economics are going on down there are. But anyway, going over, Europe kind of had a sour day. It kind of tailed off a little hard there at the end, but for the most part, it just sort of drifted a little bit bullish and then a little bit bearish through the day. But as we come down here to ours, the Dow Jones is just dropping 1.5% so far. I think we're nearing the end of trading here. S&P 500 down more than 1%, and the NASDAQ getting hit even more than 1%. So it's definitely bear territory, and you will still see a few up days, but for the most part, we're going to have an eroding. The markets are going to shed value pretty significantly over the foreseeable future. Coming down here, we have our usual excitement. Brent crude is up at 103, and the average crude is up above 96. So it's definitely going to be expensive gasoline. You already see that it's made it to about $3.99 a gallon. So it'll probably eventually get higher than that. Most analysts that I look at and talk to are saying that the price now is going to get a little higher on crude oil. Gasoline prices are probably going to find their way to $4.39 a gallon over the next few weeks, and that will definitely cause more damage to the economy as people allocate more toward gasoline and your food and other goods that are dependent upon transportation are going to suffer price increases as well with these energy cost increases. Let me get into a little detail. The passage that gets oil out of the Gulf and onto the high seas is called the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has blocked the Strait of Hormuz and is not allowing traffic to go through it. So all that is now bottled bottled up, trying to get out, and it can't because it'll get sunk. However, there is oil coming out through the strait. It is oil. We call these oil-bearing ships that get through the Strait of Hormuz are called dark transits. In the last 48 hours, there have been approximately 90 dark transits. And how are they getting out? Because they're paying their fees to Iran in Chinese currency, yuan, instead of in the classic, we always did it this way, American petrodollar. So there is oil coming out of the Middle East. And it's just not as plentiful as it was, and it will get even less plentiful over the next few months because a number of oil refineries in the Gulf have been bombed. However, there are other resources for oil. As I said, even though Russia was supposed to have been banned from shipping oil out of its territories, it is now with our tacit approval. That's getting over to India and to other places. And so we do have that flow of oil. We are going to pay a high premium on the oil that we used to get from Canada because we've pissed them off finally to the point where they're just simply going to slap massive tariffs on everything they send out of send down to us. That does not include, that's not just oil. We have critical agricultural products that we don't have that we get, we used to get at a nice discount from Canada. Now we're going to pay a premium if we even can afford them. One of those is what is called potash, which is put on just about every field in the United States in the spring. Without potash, our yields are going to be terrible compared to what they've been over the past few decades. And to give you an idea of how bad that is, I'll show you a big ag company, CAG, ConAgra. And this will show you what the markets, how the markets are assessing it. ConAgra is down 4.25%. That's not just big ag, that's ginormous ag. And it's shed about, it's May by the end of the day, shed 5% of stock value in one trading session, which is just insane. That gives you an idea of just how serious the problem we have created is for ourselves. And we won't get Canada back because it's just signed an agreement to deliver all of its stuff that it had used to send down to us. It's now going to send under agreement to China. And so this gives you an idea of just one of many, many moving parts in this degradation of the future that we are facing right now. And this isn't opinion. These are numbers. These are people whose whole lives are driven by the greed of the markets. I'll show you a stock. Looking at the sector map here, just real quick, just to give you a, where's our, my sector map? Oh, I'm on the wrong screen for it. Apologies. Look at the sector map. It's pretty much all red today. Even the technology stocks, which are usually, even on bad days, in the green, they're down here in the red as well. So this gives you an idea of how broad-based this bear market is becoming. Coming over here, just to look at one of these tech companies, Apple, AAPL. See what it's looking at? Okay, it's down 1.5% today. One of those stocks that just doesn't do things like that is doing things like that. That's the technology sector. You can look at other sectors too, and you can see that it's just broad-based, the erosion of stock prices right now. And like I said, this isn't just a temporary, well, tomorrow it'll all be over. No, this is something that is, to a certain extent, for you, it's generational. And so that's where we're standing right now. Without depressing you any further with this, what we want to do at this point, well, why don't you sign into Attendance Radar and I'll get things set up for you. Actually, I'll
I'll just bring it up here.
The subject of this lecture is a formula that tells us the relationship between the risk of a stock or portfolio and what you should expect it to return for you. It's actually, the formula is pretty straightforward, but I've even made up a little spreadsheet for you to be able to do problems without the risk of making a mistake in them. But before I get to that little formula sheet and all of that, something that I want to show you, talk about, is risk itself. We need to quantify risk. We can't just say, oh, that's risky, that's not risky. We want numbers to put on it so that we can get calculations of the level of risk and therefore the amount of return that you expect. So to start it out, though, I will need to break down risk into several components. A term that has come about in textbooks in the last maybe 10 years is the term standalone risk. It's sort of like the overall risk of a company. If it is just sitting there on its own, your whole portfolio is that company's stock. But there are parts to that risk. There is a part that we would call the company risk, the internal risk of the company, its management, its the kinds of projects it takes on, its those kinds of internals that in that managerial accounting or management overall takes into consideration. But then there's this kind of risk that is called market risk. Market risk is not the total risk of a stock. It is the risk only having to do with what the market is doing. A stock will have two kinds of risk. The total risk we can describe, break down into a kind of systematic risk. It is in the system. It does not get shaken out. It's there. That's the risk that you are taking, expecting a reward for. We sometimes call systematic risk non-diversifiable risk. It is the risk that can't be diversified away. You can't get rid of it by buying more stocks. But then there is this risk that you can get rid of. It is called non-systematic risk. It's not in the system itself. It could be cut off. It could be taken away. This is sometimes called diversifiable risk. You, sir, are very sick. You have cancer, but you also have this great big ugly nodule on your nose. Now, I can't do anything about what's inside of you. That's in your system. But that nodule, you give me a good pocket knife, I'll cut it off for you. Okay? That is non-systematic risk. It can be removed. It can be taken away. And all you have to do is diversify your portfolio, and it will begin to shed out. Give you a construct of this. What I'm going to do here is I'm going to tell a couple of you about the rest of your lives. So here are, in terms of healthcare costs, on a timeline from the beginning of your life to the end of your life, going forward through time. Now, what I'll do is I will find two people here, and I might as well, since I've done an operation on you, I'll talk about yours first. You were born ugly kid, and you were very sickly. High health care costs, you had illnesses, lots of them. You had very bad diapers. But then in your toddler years, in your preteen years, you all were always getting into trouble, broke a leg, got bad off from other illnesses, and then you found out about girls. That didn't help you at all. And then a few other problems going into your teen, your early 20s to early 30s. And then came the diabetes, overweight, ED, and all these kinds of things. You got a little healthier, but then you started getting into old age disease. You had to start buying diapers. And then you got real sick, and then you die. There's your life. Now, madam, I'm going to talk about your life. Well, you started out as a pretty healthy kid. Came out, you did good. You had a few problems in your earlier years. Found out about boys. Then you found out about alcohol and drugs. And then you got your act together. You were feeling good. But then you got into your later years and you had some problems, but they weren't too bad. High blood pressure. And then you had that tummy tuck done. And then you had a few other operations. But then you get into your old age and you're getting some sicknesses and health and then more sicknesses. And then you have to be in a nursing home. And then you start babbling and then you die. The thing here is that something is going on under the surface. You notice that those two jagged lines are not perfectly correlated. Sometimes when you are ill, she isn't too bad off. Sometimes when she's bad off, you're bad off, she's good here. And there are a few times when you're good and she's not so good. This is a well-known phenomenon that happens all through the universe. Not just in the healthcare. But what will happen is if I put in thousands of these healthcare graphs, put them all together, eventually the summation of them will show up as a straight line, a predictable outcome, or nearly predictable. This is how health insurance works. The more people you put in, the more you can very precisely calculate the insurance, healthcare insurance premium. You can calculate your total cost because some people are getting sick while some people are well, and those people who are well, they get sick and the other people get well. And over a large population, they cancel out the non-systematic part of the risk profile of the entire pool of insurance. We see this all through the universe. The insane motion of single molecules of oxygen, yes, they're dioxide molecules, they are bouncing around going absolutely ape. But when you put them all together in a room, there is no movement, there's hardly any wind, there's no collection of them over here slamming over there. They behave themselves. We see it in those beautiful galaxies. If you looked at closely, you would see absolute madness happening. Explosions, supernova, collapses of stars into black holes. You see the formations, the wild formations of planets from planetary disks. It's there too. You see it in art. I've taken, long ago, I took a group of kids down to the St. Louis Art Museum. They were having a display of Impressionist artists. One of them was Monet. And there was this one girl in the group. She was had her face right up against this painting. And I just said, I came up to her, I said, it's pretty messy, isn't it? And she said, yeah. I said, well, let's walk back here and turn around and look from 20 feet. And suddenly, it looks perfect. It's beautiful. This is the nature of the universe, that the chaos at the tiny level becomes coherent and observable and predictable by mathematics and by visual inspection at the large level. This is what we rely on in portfolio control theory, is that once you start putting stocks together in a portfolio, they begin to behave. And we no longer care about sigma, the total risk. What we care about is this calculation we call beta. Because the other part, no market is going to reward you for taking risks that you could get rid of. Here's a kind of a slap together profile, and you can see these on Google Images. You can look at a lot of these. If you look at the risk of a portfolio against number of stocks in it, what you will see is that if with one stock you have all of the sigma of that stock, but as you start adding to the portfolio, the total risk of the portfolio begins to fall, and eventually it begins to ride along an asymptote, which is the market's risk. How many stocks would it take to do that? Well, the problem is about 30 stocks is kind of like a benchmark. At 30 stocks, you've gotten rid of maybe about 95% of the non-systematic risk, the diversifiable risk. So it takes quite a few stocks to do it. But one thing is critical when you are selecting stocks for a portfolio. How much correlation do they have to each other? In other words, two stocks that have a high correlation, in other words, they move very well together, you wouldn't want those in a portfolio because they're not doing anything to cancel out each other's non-systematic risk. So what you want to do is look for stocks that have low correlation coefficients. And let me see if I can find that real quick here. I'll take this over. I can't bookmark here, so I'll have to just sort of take a stab at it using Google to get to where I want to be, the portfolio visualizer. Portfolio visualizer. Correlation. Here we go. This is a site, it's free, and you can just key in stock symbols, and it will show you how much correlation those two stocks returns have. And it's not prices, it's returns. So let me put in a few here. I don't know, I'll put in Kroger, maybe Facebook, Meta. Oops, try that again. Kroger, Meta, I don't know, Ford, what else would I want to put in here? Colgate-Palmolive, CL, NVIDIA, and let's do Lockheed Martin. Oops. LMT. And let me put in Pfizer as well. PFE. Now, what will come out is what's called a correlation matrix. You may have seen those before. Huh? Oh, FRKR. Good. Thank you. Okay. View the correlation matrix. Now, this is symmetric along the diagonal. So I can see that Kroger is has a correlation of its returns with the stock of Meta of 0.16. That's good. My rule is anything below 0.30, those would play well together in a portfolio. In other words, they're not working together to create volatility. They're working only weekly. Meta, yeah. Ford, matter of fact, Kroger, if you look across here, it has a low correlation with everything I've got in this list. We sometimes call a stock like that an anchor stock. It's one where you might start with that one, and then you would have a good other stocks you would put in later, you would be pretty confident that they would have low correlations. In other words, they're suppressing, they're draining that non-systematic risk pretty well against each other. Now, if I look at Meta against Ford, it's okay. Against Colgate-Palmolive, good. Now, here's one that persistently drives me crazy. Sometimes it's obvious why they have a high correlation, but Meta against Nvidia, it just they're too correlated at 0.34. Why? I mean, I guess you could think Meta does have is definitely a high tech in some of its stuff, but anyway, I would not want to put Meta and Nvidia in a portfolio together. But Meta works well, definitely works well with Lockheed Martin. They're so different. Lockheed Martin is a war company. And against Pfizer, Meta is good too. So if I wanted Meta in my portfolio, I would want to avoid having Nvidia in the portfolio or vice versa. Coming down, look at Ford. Nvidia is weird. It just correlates too often with other things. It's almost like Nvidia is almost like a negative anchor. It's one that it correlates too much, too often with other things. But Ford against Lockheed Martin, yeah, and against PFE, those are both low correlation coefficients. So yeah, those two would be good in a portfolio together. Colgate-Palmolive against Nvidia. Well, there's some news. Colgate certainly isn't interested in playing with Nvidia. That would be a good pair. But then Colgate against, why in the blazes would Colgate, you know, toothpaste and stuff like that, correlate so highly with Lockheed Martin, which has nothing to do with it? So like I said, sometimes you can't really explain it, but whether or not you can explain it, just don't do it. Don't put those together, because those two are way too closely, their returns move way too closely together. And Pfizer, well, Colgate and Pfizer, I guess that kind of makes sense that they're sort of correlated, because, you know, both of them deal in consumer goods, I guess. Lockheed Martin is correlated with Pfizer, pretty nasty correlation. So this is the way we would look at forming a well-informed portfolio where each new stock you put into it would help cool off that non-diversifiable risk. The lower the correlations, the more you are draining that non-diversifiable risk out of your portfolio with each new addition. So this is sort of a little practical side to it. And this thing has been around. This portfolio visualizer is well known among stock professionals, but it's not well known among amateur investors. So just kind of keep this in the back of your mind. It's something to have for future reference. If you're thinking about, well, I've got a couple of stocks, I'm thinking about buying this stock, look at it on the visualizer to see if it is going to contribute to portfolio diversification very well or not so well. Okay. Now, ideally, you can actually find some correlation coefficients that are negative. Those are great if you can find those, but it's not that easy to find those. Okay, now let me take you over here and do a couple of things for you. First of all, this thing called beta, and I've been using it all semester long, so that I would prefer that you understand why, what its important is before I give you a formula for it. But think about beta measures a risk. Now, there are a couple of things that we use in finance, variables or parameters or whatever you want to call them, that are theoretical. We can't tolerate those. Yeah, it's great we do the theory, but how do we get a number instead of a theoretical variable letter, a Greek letter or, you know, some like that? We need to be able to calculate things. Two theoreticals that I've brought up, well, there are three theoreticals. One is the risk-free rate. That is a riskless security. Now, that doesn't exist in the real world, but we do have some that are very close to being risk-free. The one that I've mentioned before, which we often use, is the one-year treasury bill yield. It is so close to being riskless that we use that one. I've shown you that chart, you know, the one-year 4.35% or whatever. That's our proxy, as it were, because this is going to show up in a theoretical formula, but if we want to make that actionable, we need a number. So for the risk-free rate, we usually use the T-bill rate. Another one is the expected return to the market portfolio. Now, the market portfolio is a theoretical portfolio of every security in the world in a single portfolio. And obviously, we can't do that. Now, we just can't. We can't build a portfolio that would have every stock, every bond in it. We just couldn't do that. However, we do have some real-world things that are very close to being the world portfolio, at least in terms of how much of the total value of the world is in them. One of those is the S&P 500. It's 500 of the largest companies on Earth. And so in a way, that is really significantly the market portfolio. So oftentimes we will proxy the world portfolio with the Standard & Poor's 500 index. Another way that we often do it in practice is there are a number of services that have experts anywhere from a handful to 60, 100. Experts who each contribute their estimate of what the next year's return to the market will be. I'm in one of those. I contribute what I think it will be, and about 70 others in my index have their estimates, and they take the average and they say, okay, the expected return to the market portfolio for the next year will be like 8.6%. Now, there are a lot of services that do this, and some are much more reliable as far as their how close their predictions were. Mine's not too bad, the one I'm in. So we're saying right now we expect that the expected return to the market portfolio over the next year is 8.6%. So again, it's a theoretical value, but we need an actual number to put on it, to pin on it. Okay, so now that one. Now the next one is beta itself. The beta of a stock or of a portfolio. You could do it either way. Where in the heck do we get that thing? It's actually a formula. And I'll even write the formula down here for you. It's the standard deviation of the returns to that stock divided by the standard deviation of the market portfolio's return times the correlation coefficient of that stock with the market. That is the Greek letter rho, R-H-O. That's how we calculate it. We look at the standard deviation of returns to a stock, and then we look at the standard deviation of returns to the S&P 500, and then we multiply that by the correlation coefficient, you know, like what the portfolio visualizer does. I could even show you something here. Watch this. First, there are two things I need to show. I want to show you here. One of them is, let me do this first. Okay, there are two touchstone points on beta. The beta of the risk-free rate is 0.00. It is completely riskless. If you think about it, the correlation coefficient of anything with something that has no movement is going to be zero. That's why beta comes out to be zero for the risk-free rate. Another one is the beta of the market portfolio. That's 1.00, simply because you'd be taking the standard deviation of the market over the standard deviation of the market times the correlation of the market with itself, so it's one. And that would be enough for us to graph something. If I graph beta here and the expected return to a stock, I know that if the beta is zero of the stock, it will be located at the risk-free rate. We know that if the beta of a stock is 1.00, it will have the return, expected return to the market portfolio. So this line right here is the graph we call the securities, that's plural, securities market line. You can tell me the beta of any stock and I can tell you what its expected return will be. A beta, let's say 0.6, right about there, that would have an expected return about there. A beta of 1.4 right there, that would have an expected return about up there. The securities market line is the graph of the capital asset pricing model. But I'll do that in just a second. Let me show you something here. Let me go back to Yahoo Finance. I've shown you this one before. I've shown you this one before. Markets. There's an ETF called SPY, S-P-Y. Excuse me. S-P-Y. It is the Standard & Poor's 500. It's a beautifully well-diversified portfolio. It represents so close to the world portfolio. Look at its beta. It basically is the world portfolio, as I had explained earlier. See how its beta is exactly 1.00? That's about, in other words, those 500 companies, basically, they're the world. The rest of us don't matter. Now, there's another one. If you don't like stocks, or if you'd like to balance stocks with bonds, there's another one that is bonds, AGG. This one is so well respected that it is the benchmark that against which any bond or bond portfolio is compared these days. AGG. Now, look at AGG. It is almost a perfect world portfolio. So one way that we talk to investors, we suggest investors consider, is that you have money. So put some of it into SPY and the rest into AGG. Like, for example, if we are in a bull market, maybe 80% in SPY, 20% in AGG. Because then you got two perfectly well-diversified portfolios. They both are tracking the world portfolio perfectly. And so, well, when things get bad, you move it over maybe 25% SPY and 75% AGG. So in other words, you have just two well-managed, they're managed by some of the top professionals in the business. So you don't have to worry about portfolio balancing and all that portfolio control theory put into practice. You just handle those and you sort of move them as you consider the market's prospects. In bad times, bonds dominate. In good times, stocks dominate. So that's a practical way. And you know that the portfolio beta of the whole thing you have will be about 1.00. In other words, you are riding the world market with that pair of subcomponents of the portfolio. Anyway, the securities market line. Here is the capital asset pricing model. It's actually a very simple equation, and a lot more complex equations have come out over the years. There's one called the arbitrage pricing theory, APT, and others. But this one stands as very good at predicting the expected return to a stock or to a portfolio of stocks. You can do it with a portfolio too. The first thing it has is the risk-free rate. Every stock has to have, be able to deliver what a riskless stock would deliver. So the risk-free rate starts it off. And then we have this component right here. R sub M, the return to the market, minus the return to the risk-free. We call this the market premium over risk-free. In other words, you'll hear me, by the way, you'll hear me call this the market premium. What this does is tell you the reward to taking risk instead of no risk. Let me explain. You, madam, you could have graduated from high school and gone out and gotten a job. You could have made $10 an hour, no, 15. But so, in other words, that's a riskless investment. But instead, you went to college. You came here. You took the risk that you would have to take finance from an old, foul-mouthed, big-nosed professor. And you did it anyway. You took risk. And you are doing that not because you love your self-education, but because you expected to make more taking that risk. So in other words, you might expect to make $50 an hour with your bachelor's degree. 50 minus 15 is your risk premium for doing that. That's why it's here. But every stock has a level of risk, so we scale that by the beta. So if you look at that, the beta is actually a magnifier and demagnifier of the market premium. So in other words, you take on a stock with a beta of 1.2, what you're really saying is I'm going to take the risk 120% of the market premium. That's what you're saying. If you take on a stock, if you buy a stock with a beta of 0.6, that's saying I want only 60% of the market premium. That's what beta is. It's just a magnifier and demagnifier of market premium over risk-free. That is called the capital asset pricing model. It has stood the test of time very well. You'll see if you type capital asset pricing model or CAPM in images in Google, you'll see that securities line is the graph of that. Its y-intercept is R sub f. Its slope is the market premium. Now that slope can change over time, of course. The market, the securities market line is constantly nudging around. Like for example, if the Fed were to lower interest, the risk-free rate on the T-bills, then the line would kind of tell, but market, the expected return to the market stays the same, then this line would kind of rotate that way. Another one is if inflation starts to come in, everything goes up, so the securities market line lifts upward. Let me show you something here. But this is the CAPM, and it does a very good job of forecasting the expected return. Now, that doesn't mean you'll get that return. This is expectation. But over a long period of time, that is going to be about what you should expect, is what CAPM is going to tell you. Now, there have been so many master's theses and PhD dissertations over the years have collected data on this to see if these, if data points do line up with CAPM pretty tightly. And the answer is yes, they do. They actually do very well in regressions, line of best fit, you know, all that kind of stuff. It does. Now, there are two exceptions. Well, actually, there are more than two. There are some kinds of stocks that tend to sort of not be on the securities market line. One of them, there's something called the small cap effect. Very small companies tend to be above the line more than they're below the line. So in other words, there's kind of a bias, and there are explanations out there that are pretty good for why that is. Then there is an odd thing called the January effect. There are certain stocks that every January, they tend to be on above the securities market line. Why? That one is a lot of debate. We can't really pin down an answer for that. Why certain stocks always, every January, kind of break the CAPM a little bit. But there's something else that I want to mention. The CAPM tells you what a portfolio of stocks or a stock should earn. So if I were to draw the securities market line, at here's R sub F, it goes up like that, that's beta of zero, that's maybe the beta of one there. Oddly enough, there are some times when you'll see a portfolio sitting well above where it should be for its beta. It's return is above CAPM. The question is, okay, not actually why, but who? We don't see it very often at all, but we do see it. This abnormal return right here, this little distance between what it should earn by theory and what it does earn in reality, we have a name for it. We call it Jensen's alpha. Jensen's alpha. Now, Jensen's alpha could be negative, but obviously we're not really interested in that. But we do see some investors who have persistently positive Jensen's alphas. And they are quite interesting to us. As a matter of fact, there's a highly respected website, and I use it, and I've gotten a lot of knowledge from it, and it's called Seeking Alpha. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of it, but go to Google and type in Seeking Alpha. They do have a paid version, but even their free version gives a lot of great investment advice. And obviously, they are helping everyone seek alpha. They are seeking alpha with us, that extra return that should not be there. And we, first of all, they aren't the only ones who are seeking alpha. We constantly, you get a brokerage account, free trades, we'll give you even $20 to join us and all this kind of stuff. And then you can track your portfolio and invest all you want. Well, they're doing that for free because they're seeking alphas. They're actually following every one of their investors to see if who in 100,000 accounts, 500,000 accounts, who has a persistently positive alpha. Because, of course, once we know who you, maybe I've seen you. You just keep getting above the securities market line. CAPM says you should earn 12% on your beta. You keep earning 14.2% on your beta. Well, then what we're going to do is we're going to identify you, and then every time you make a trade, we're going to front run you. You put in a trade, well, we're going to put in the trade exactly like you did, except a lot bigger, based on your order. And then we'll fill your order after we've done it. That's called front running. And all the time, we're seeking the alphas, looking for those investors who keep winning more than they should. Like at the casino, watching who will do that, who will keep winning more than he or she should. We even do it. I took my students up to White Sox some years back to have them help them get some internships and jobs in their charitable operations program up there, which in the summers they sponsor thousands of little league teams all over Chicagoland. And of course, it keeps the kids off the streets, teaches them sportsmanship. It's great. But of course, they're also looking for that 1 in 1,000 kid playing ball who has an arm that can throw a pitch or has something about the way he swings that bat. They do it in that business too. We're constantly in everything we do looking for the alpha that tells us this is a valuable commodity. Like you, if we can identify that you are constantly earning more than you should on your portfolio based upon the beta, that tells us we've got to make you our friend. You don't know we're your friend, but we are your friend. Okay? So this idea of alpha is actually important. You have these stock competitions. The team that gets the highest return, well, they're the greatest, and we're going to give them money and pat them on the butt, all that. That's ridiculous. All you have to do to earn more is to get farther out on the securities market line. That means nothing. What really means something is if a team gets an alpha that's positive. That's what I do when I judge these competitions. I don't care if that team made 35% on its portfolio. It was clear out there in the beta 2.5. What I actually, some years back, one team earned a lousy 4.2%, but their beta said that they should have earned only about 1.9%. They were the winners. I voted for them to be the winners, not because they got the most, but because they broke alpha up into the stratosphere compared to what they should have. 1.9, that's what they should have earned. Well, they earned almost, two and a half times what they should have earned. So keep that in mind when they brag about how much they made with their portfolio. You ask them, what beta did you get? And given that beta, what should you have earned? Oftentimes you'll find that with betas that high, they didn't earn as much as they should have, according to the securities market line. So always keep that in mind when you're thinking about investing. It's not what you make. It's what you did that was better than what you should have based upon the CAPM. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.